Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, emotion worker, and mental health consultant. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Brian.
How are you today?
I'm doing quite well, and how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those different days where we're going to shake things up a little bit in the studio. We're not going to be opening up the phone lines to taking calls. We're going to be doing everything in-house today. We have a couple guests in here. And so we're kind of resetting our flow a little bit. But I think it'll still be fun. I'm really excited about the topic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's something that you'll be able to participate in, even though Kieran is just a year.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of this topic, a lot of these conversations are going to be things that you're going to be thinking about and talking about over the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited to jump into it. But this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and we do gather every week to talk about those things that a lot of us struggle with, most of us struggle with at some point in our life, grapple with in our day-to-day, trying to be the best humans that we can be. And so we come together to kind of share our thoughts and ideas. And you can be part of the conversation, not on the phone today, but in other ways, by finding us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, or to our website. You can check that out, thereluctanttherapist.com. I post old shows. I talk about upcoming shows. You can leave comments and feedback at the website. And then you can also go to our newly updated webpage here at kcbx.org, where there's all sorts of information about upcoming programming and what's going on at the station. And if you go to, we're under news and talk, right?
Mm-hmm.
News and talk, and we're very bottom, The Reluctant Therapist, and all of our old shows are there. Also, if you'd like to podcast them at a different time. So I'm excited that you're here and joining our broadcast today, because we're going to talk about parenting and children and that stress that we feel to do everything just right, and how our whole focus of parenting has changed over the last few generations. Let's say the last 150 years. Because 150 years ago, you know, half of children didn't even live out of childhood. You were happy if your children made it out of childhood. And the other half of our children were kind of a built-in labor force for the family. Many of our families were rural agriculture, and so you needed more hands in the field, and our children became the worker bees, and we became more industrialized. Children were actually going into factories and doing labor as early as 10 years old and helping provide an income for the family. So we had a much different sense of what children's purpose was in our families 150 years ago. And then as things went along, when we had mandatory education through high school in the early 19th century, with that change and also laws banning children from being in factory settings, once we had those laws in place, then all of a sudden we had this much greater opportunity for childhood, where children were out playing and riding bikes and exploring and being kids, just playing out in the world. And so for many people, my guests included and myself, when we were coming up through childhood, your moms and dads kicked you out the door in the morning, sometimes with a snack if you're lucky, and said, you know, be back at dinner when you hear us whistle and don't die. Which is about the end of the instructions for childhood. And so it was up to us to find our way of building forts or playing games or have pickup games. And as things have changed and we got more organized with little leagues and soccer and dance classes, and that's just escalated and escalated over the last 30, 40 years, to the point now where the focus of our lives as parents is on every breath and activity and movement of our children. We're taking Snapchats and pictures and posting and catching every little nuanced movement of their lives. And we have our children scheduled in activities from baby sign language, learning languages, to getting into preschools. And it's just overwhelming. The noise in our head when it comes to parenting is incredible. And along with that comes a lot of pressure to be perfect as parents, to do everything just right, to read every book or talk to every person or follow every expert, because we feel like we have one chance to bring up a child that's going to, you know, glorify the world. I mean, basically, the pressure now is for every person to raise the next superstar in some way. And we all believe that we're raising the next superstar. And every person believes that their child is the most gifted and talented child that was ever born, because we have so much of our ego and our sense of well-being and our sense of accomplishment wrapped up in what our children end up doing. And on the plus side, we have raised a couple generations of supremely accomplished children who have achieved more than I did at a young age. They've traveled more. They've do better in school. They have higher grade point averages. They excel in music. They excel in sports. I mean, at more higher levels, more children are doing well. But on the downside, we also have this mindset that every child that we have has to be gifted and talented, somehow a prodigy or exceptionally amazing at something. You know, children are going to write books, or my child's going to be the next Olympian. But if you read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, do you ever read that? I highly recommend it. But one of the things he talks about is this idea that even a prodigy, someone who is naturally gifted at something, puts in 10,000 hours before they get to the mastery of whatever that gift is. And so right there is a lot of controversy. And as parents, should we be pushing our children into 10,000 hours of anything? Is that healthy for our children, and is that healthy for parents? And then the other side also is this idea that every child is potentially gifted and talented. So I was looking at some research about gifted and talented children, and really they found that 10 to 15% of all students are high achievers. So 10 to 15%, they're, you know, 85% are just average learners, average great people that are going to grow up and do good things. But only 10 to 15 are high achievers. And only the top 2 to 5% of students actually would be considered gifted children. And prodigies are actually just gifted children to the extreme. But gifted children, you know, have had this high praise and mythology around them based on a lot of research that was done 20, 30, 40 years ago. Actually, it was a study that was done over a course of 70 years following gifted children and how they fared in the world. And that research found that not only are gifted children superior when it came to academic challenges, but they also were superior in health, in social adjustment, and moral attitude. So this gave rise to this mythology that if you had a gifted and talented child, they were also going to be happy and healthy and thriving. But unfortunately, there's also been research to the contrary over the last 20, 30 years that kind of countered or questioned that original finding that gifted and talented children were happy and well-adjusted. And one of the things they questioned was the way they found these gifted and talented children was on recommendations by teachers. And the teachers would choose the best and the brightest. And what they found is the teachers quite often would have other gifted and talented children, but they would be considered more misfits, like the loners or the ones that were difficult to teach or weren't engaged in school. They might have been brilliant, but the teachers didn't single them out as gifted and talented because they were more of a challenge. So that's kind of skewed the findings. And current research has found that actually, you know, children who are highly gifted, high abilities in areas, not just in academics, but also in visual or performing arts or athletics, these children actually were really out of step with their peers, that they socially really struggled because they are in a place which is beyond their average peer group, so they couldn't relate and ended up being really highly driven in their area that they were interested in and very independent. But at the same time, they also were very introverted. These gifted and talented children end up being very isolated and spending much more time alone than is normal or considered healthy, that they're very isolated in their actions. And although the children overall derive a lot of pleasure from that solitary time doing whatever their gift is, overall, they also report feeling really lonely. So in this conversation with the reluctant therapist today, we're talking about gifted and talented children, or do we want to push each of our children to become gifted and talented or to spend 10,000 hours? Is that really what it's all about as an adult? Because the takeaway from these studies looking at gifted and talented children who've been pushed is that 20 to 25% of them are profoundly gifted children have social and emotional problems. And that's almost twice the normal rate of average children. And by middle childhood, many of these gifted and talented children actually make efforts to hide any of their gifts in an effort to be popular and to get along with others in their peer group. And this actually hurts academically gifted girls more than academically gifted boys. So as a mother who is at the end of my child rearing, active child rearing days, part of me is relieved. I'm taking a huge breath, like, oh, I'm kind of moving away from that intensity of this full barrage of parenting. And am I doing the most for my child? And are they getting everything they need? And to be able to step back a little bit and say, gosh, now I'm kind of looking at all the ways as a parent that I might have overdone or overstepped or wish I'd pulled back or maybe pushed harder. And so that's on my mind today. And I brought in two experts in the field of working with children and helping to cultivate their gifts, but also, more importantly, helping children learn to enjoy being children, how to play and use their bodies and their minds and to really get the most out of their lives. And so I've brought my friend experts in today to kind of share a bit of their wisdom to maybe help other parents who are grappling with this noise in the culture that every child needs to be the next superstar, and how do I get the most for my child? Or to help parents say, I'm going to step back and let my child just go out and play. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. In studio today with my guests, Paul Fiala and Jennifer Blomfield, we've changed things up a little bit. We're not going to be taking phone calls. We're just going to be having the conversation here. But I'm really excited to hear what my guests have to say about the topic around children and activities. So I think we'll start with Jennifer Blomfield. You are a teacher at Mission Prep, and you've also been very involved in children's theater and theater yourself for many years. Can you tell us a little bit more about what brought you into working with children and what you do currently?
Well, I think it started when I was 17 years old. I always loved working with kids, and I started teaching this little movement class at a parks and recreation site in the ghetto in Anchorage, Alaska. And that was one of my first learning experiences of how different my life was with the kids and the projects. I also know that kids are kids, and it doesn't matter if they come from the wealthiest family or the poorest family, that their need to be spontaneous and to play is primary in growth and development mm-hmm. of the child and of the adult. Both children and adults, without play, we see all these issues that you just spoke so beautifully about. After college, I was got my degree in theater, musical theater, and I had a career as a singer and on the professional stage. And then I opened a dance studio in Alaska. And then I moved here to California and started teaching children's theater while raising my three daughters. When I turned 50, when I thought I was pretty much done and I was almost finished raising my children, I got a phone call from Mission College Prep asking if I would apply for their theater drama position. And it was very daunting at first because I just finished the teenage years, which were extremely exhausting. And I really had never been a teacher. But I thought, well, if they want me to do this, I will jump in. And I've now been there 9 years, and I absolutely love it. And I have to say that the children and these young adolescents have taught me more about parenting and about what their needs are. So as we all say as parents, boy, if I had to do it over again. So I also am getting my license as a marriage family therapist and have completed my 3,000 hours, and I'm now just waiting for that letter to take the final test. So I don't work as a therapist at Mission College Prep, but I do talk to a lot of kids, and they come to me just to chat about issues. So I think that I know a little bit about teenage angst and anxiety and pressures.
Absolutely.
And the need to belong.
And also, you've worked with all ages, so you understand and have seen, I'm sure, children of all levels and abilities from young ages growing all the way up through high school, and the parental involvement. So I'm excited to talk more about what you've seen done well and what you would have hopefully seen parents do differently. My other guest today is Paul Fiala, who is a local tennis coach who I've known because both of my girls grew up playing tennis with you, and I play tennis with you myself. Paul's probably my physical therapist because we get together every...
But I'm not reluctant.
No, you're not. But we get together every week and hit tennis balls and chat endlessly about what's going on in our lives. And so I thought you'd also have some great wisdom about working with children because you, too, have been involved in honing children's excitement about tennis for many years. Can you tell us more about how you got involved in that work?
I started teaching when I was in high school. Ordered to raise some money. So we would run clinics, and I started thinking, you know, this is kind of fun, and I couldn't afford college when I got out of high school, so we went. I went in the Army, and I got to teach in the Army, and that was a nice gig. So got out of the Army, GI Bill paid for my college, and I started coaching a little bit of the kids on the side, and then the Cal Poly coaches came up and said, hey, you know, how about helping us out a little bit? And I was like, okay. And, you know, everybody asked me, you know, well, did you play professionally? No, I like teaching. I've always liked teaching. I got a nice break in the mid-'80s with a wonderful lady named Joanna Santasiri, who passed away a few years ago. She got me a job down in L.A. at Adidas Tennis Camps. And by the second year, I was a director, and I did that for 12 years. Saw about 10,000 kids, and did some high school coaching, and then got my own program at the Sinsheimer Park here in San Luis as the city director. Went from there to Avila, did 12 years at Avila as the head coach, director of tennis, and left there in 2006, and am currently working at the home court, which is my court at my house. And I have a great clientele, including you.
Thank you.
And it's been a great trip.
So why don't you start talking a little bit about, have you seen a difference in kids who come out to play tennis now and when you started 20 or 30 years ago, or are they different at all about tennis or their desire to play? And is it the parents that have changed? What have you seen?
You know, I think in the 80s and the 90s, it was a little bit more hectic. It was a little bit, you know, pushier. I remember a lot of the juniors that I dealt with down in L.A. were, that the parents were frantic, you know, dropping the child off to, you know, 7 days of immersion in tennis. You must, you know, and you could just see them. Their eyes are spinning in their head, and they're like, you know, make sure little Bobby does this and this and this and this. And I'm like, okay, well, yeah, you know, you nod a lot and go, okay, and then you hopefully have a hell of a good time. So, and I think recently what I've seen is the parents are backing off quite a bit more.
Hmm.
And I don't get the real, you know, holy mackerels, you know. I do remember, you know, watching my kids play down in Santa Barbara and sitting next to Wayne Bryan, who's the father of the Bryan brothers.
Yeah.
And my student was playing against his son, and he was talking about it, and, you know, he's a heck of a coach, and he was a pusher.
Mm-hmm.
But his kids loved it, because no matter win or lose, he always took the kids out afterwards and got ice cream or whatever. Then there was the Rettenmeyers, which were really nice people, but really driven, and they would sit and chain smoke on the sidelines while their son played, and their son would look at him, you know, at the parents every 5 seconds, you know, am I doing good? Am I doing good? And here's a 9-year-old cheating his way through every tournament just so he could please them and win. So that was the late 80s, 90s. But since then, it's not as much. At least I haven't seen it.
Which is probably nice for you.
Yes.
Because you have the joy of kids that are coming out just playing and having a good time.
I try to temper the parents right away. And when I do get a parent that's really angstful, I typically will sit down with them and I'll show them some good books to read and say, you know, this is how you really develop somebody. If you really want to develop your child into a really great, great, great player, here's what you do. You get a developmental plan. You get a schedule, and, you know, and here's your responsibility as the adult. This is what I need you to do. And when they start kicking in and start going, yeah, but I want to have a little bit more of a hand, you go, you know, you need to back off. It's okay. We got it under control here. Unless they're already, you know, an expert themselves, in the case of Wayne Bryan. I mean, he was an expert already.
And I think that is, you know, there's parents that come in with a very set idea of what they want for their child and where they're going to go in life, and they're going to search out, I think, the intensity of the programs that match their personal intensity. But what do you think, Jennifer, happened to play?
Well, I'm going to answer that question in a moment, but okay. I want to applaud Paul, because he said, I don't see that many kids that way now, But then what you said is you educated the parents. Mm-hmm. So really, we may still have that many kids and parents, but you have taken a wonderful opportunity to teach parents how to be better parents. And that's all we want as a parent. And when we get the education on how to soothe our children when they lose, mm-hmm. and or to back off, then they're going to do it because they want the best for their child. And you offered that to them. So I would say that you're more than just a tennis coach. So
yeah, so what might have changed really is not the parents or children, but Paul, you found some Yoda-ism in you that you were able, that maybe that you found your mojo in coaching, and maybe that's why what you're bringing to you yourself is this more balanced experience. And this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett in the studio today with my guests Paul Fiala and Jennifer Blomfield. We're talking about kids and parents, and is there mental health benefits to trying to push our children to being exceptional or prodigies or spending the 10,000 hours to master some sort of skill or academic level? Or are we pushing our children because of our own egos or our sense of competition with other parents? We're not taking calls today. We're kind of having an in-house discussion. But Jennifer, what have you seen happen over the course of your work with children? Do you see any changes or intensity?
Well, there's the triangle. There's the child, the parent, and then the coach or the teacher. And when they're all in sync, it's absolutely fabulous. But if there's just one area that's off, then everybody gets affected because everybody doesn't feel like they are contributing at their best. And how we contribute at our best, if you're a child, is if you're validated, if you're pushed to the limit that's comfortable, and then when it's the child's own empowerment of going to the next level instead of the teacher, coach, or the parent's agenda. Mm-hmm. I have worked with kids ages 3 to 18 for, okay, I'm really bad at math, but I think it's been 48 years since I was 17.
A little less, but you're good. Okay. You're aging yourself, but go with it.
So what I find fascinating is I love working with younger kids because I have an agenda. I want to be loved too. Mm-hmm. And young kids love their teachers. Mm-hmm. They throw their arms around you. They bring you little gifts, and they just can't wait to see you the next day. As soon as they hit junior high and high school, it is their job to test mm-hmm. adults. It is their job. It is the way the brain is wired. And so they're going to push their teachers because they are learning how to become adults themselves. So it makes it a lot more challenging for the teacher. And as a parent, the parent doesn't want their kid to be disrespectful, and they're not being disrespectful. They're just setting their rite of passage in place. So once again, it's more about education and validating the child. But in those years of middle school and high school, they do quit playing. Mm-hmm. They quit playing because of the pressure of life. Because right away, they have to be the best at something. They have to make sure that they go to the best college. They are put pressures in high school is unbelievable on what kind of job will I get. And I have to pick my profession now at 14.
Absolutely.
And so the pressure is even greater. And as we all know, that when the brain, the adolescent years, and it's 12 to 24, it's no longer, 13 to 18, they don't have the skills to hold all that pressure. And the stress and the anxiety, that's when the mental wellness starts to fall apart.
So what do we do then as parents to help our children, find those things that they're good at? How do we help nurture that from your perspective, as coaches and parents and teachers? We want our children to experience a lot of different activities. How do we know when to push and how do we know when to back off and say, well, maybe this isn't your gift? What has been your experience with that?
Listen to your children because they'll tell you. They'll tell you what they like and what they don't like.
But then some children won't want to do anything. We've because all three of us are parents, some kids, if given their own devices, will lay around and want to play video games all day long. So on the same hand, I have parents that push real hard. And I know parents who, because their lives are busy and they're involved with their working life and their activities, if their child is happy just playing video games all day long, then they're going to say, well, they're not interested in anything. I asked them if they wanted to play sports. They said no. I asked them if they wanted to do theater. They said no. So I am concerned that we are very out of balance in our parenting, that we have an intensity of, I need my child to be gifted and exceptional so I, as a parent, feel like I've done my job. And then parents who are so busy and overwhelmed just keeping up that these children are just lost and not being pushed at all.
Well, if you keep introducing them to different things, a child will find his niche. They find it in a social group, mm-hmm. and they find it in their passions. So as a parent, you keep wanting to give them every opportunity. And then they'll let you know, I love this or I hate it. And sometimes, yeah, you do need to push them a little. But that depends on the temperament of the child. And I'm interested in hearing from you, Paul, because you've had that range as well. And how do you push them and back off?
Well, personally, when I'm out teaching, I'm just a motivator, and I've got more energy than any of them, and they kind of will thrive on that a little bit. And as they're getting older, yeah, they do question the authority, and a lot of times they'll start wondering whether or not like when they're driving, they'll all of a sudden go, well, I don't really need to drive to clinic today. But I think, for the kids that I've got, the parents provide provide a good enough push that they've instilled in the kid that some responsibility for doing this. The kids that, I remember one kid, Travis Hassan, who was a really great local player. He hated to come to class. He hated it. But his parents, who were both Olympians, said, no, you're going. And he'd, kick and scream all the way to the door of the courts, and he'd walk on the courts, and boom, he'd have a great time. So I think the parents make better decisions than the kids do, because kids don't make really good adult decisions until they're adults. And so a lot of times we, as adults, parents, coaches, we have to push enough to allow them the chance to realize what they could possibly do with it. And then if, in the end they just really didn't like it, or if it really wasn't for them, like you said, they'll find their niche in something mm-hmm. else.
So that moment when you see the light go on for kids on the court, like, I actually am good at this. Talk about that.
Well, everybody wants to be successful, and I think that's one of the reasons why right now a lot of the kids do classes only. Mm-hmm. They're professional lesson takers. They come out to clinic, they take their private lesson, and then I'll go, okay, now you need to play Fred, Barney, and Wilma. And they're like, no, that's too scary. No, because they don't want to fail. But in class, they're champs, because the coach is there supporting them, the parents are supporting them. It's like, okay, I'm good here. It's less stressful. If you want to get out into the real world and really be good, then you have to put your skills against people you don't know. And that's scary. And that's when you've got the one, because they love it. They love the challenge. They want to get out there. They can't wait. One of the girls I coach, she goes, I just, I want to be number 30 in the Southern Cal. She made that. Oh, I want to be top 10. She made that. She goes, I want to be top. I want to be number one. Okay, and she, she's 10, just
but
turned 11.
She's got the fire.
Holy mackerel.
Wow. So there is.
But it's one in, oh gosh, it's one every 10 years.
And I think that is the key, that as parents, to be able to take a deep breath and step back and say, odds are, as disconcerting as this might be, your odds of having that gifted or exceptional is less than 2%. And so maybe we can take that deep breath as parents and back off and say, you know what? Maybe the priorities in life are much more about the whole person and not excelling or winning a prize in one area. And this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. In studio today with Paul Fiala and Jennifer Blomfield, we're talking about children and building their talents and gifts. And as as parents, trying to find a way to nurture that without burning our children out before they even get into high school. We're not taking calls today, but we're glad you're here for the conversation, and we'll be right back to continue.
You're listening to The Reluctant Therapist on Public Radio KCBX. Coming up at 3 o'clock this afternoon, it is Fresh Air with host Terry Gross. Then at 4 o'clock, American Public Media's Marketplace presents news on business, economics, and money. And at 4:30, it's All Things Considered, offering a balanced perspective on the events of the day, combining headline newscasts with personal in-depth reporting. That's coming up here on Central Coast Public Radio KCBX. The time is now 2:30.
And I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Here in the studio with Paul Fiala and Jennifer Blomfield. As I mentioned, we aren't taking calls today. We're in studio having a conversation about that noisy world of parenting and all of the pressure that we feel to do well by our children, because the whole focus of parenting has changed over the last 100 or so years, where we, you know, originally for many, many centuries, children were part of the labor force and they helped the families function either by working in the fields or working in the factory and bringing home part of the income. And then things shifted through the 40s, 50s, and 60s with changes in labor laws. All of a sudden, the job of children in childhood was to go to school and play, to leave the house in the morning and come back late at night when it was dark, and parents really weren't focused, you know, solely on every action of their child. And then things started shifting, and in the last 20, 30, 40 years, there has been such a focus on child rearing and the pressure to be perfect and to raise the next Bill Gates or LeBron James or superstar in some way, that parents feel like, you know, if I just get that 10,000 hours under the belt of my child, I'm going to have the next Olympian, that my child's health and well-being is going to be dependent on how well they do in the world as far as academically or in sports. But conversely, what we don't talk about very much is the mental health challenges that go along with being a gifted and talented and exceptionally gifted child. As I mentioned earlier, only 2 to 5% of children really are gifted and talented in an area that would lead them to being a prodigy or supremely successful in one area. But the rest of our children are doing great and should be encouraged to play and develop their whole experience as humans and really not be driven to reach excellence in one area. Because what we're finding is that a lot of these children who are gifted and talented or exceptionally gifted tend to be real isolated. They tend to be loners. They tend to be misfits. They tend to feel very lonely and out of step with their peers. And so for their mental health and well-being, you know, it's not all unicorns and rainbows. There's a lot of pressure and a lot of loneliness and sadness, and a lot of really gifted and talented children report trying to hide those gifts and talents when they reach middle school and high school so that they can be popular and fit in. So maybe this intensity we feel as parents to have our children excel in one area isn't serving their mental health and well-being. So the conversation today with Jennifer and Paul. Jennifer is very involved in the performing arts, and Paul is a local tennis coach and has had a lot of success training children of all ages. Today I wanted to ask both of them, what have you seen, where have you seen parents get into trouble when it comes to their children's abilities or their goals for their children in the performing arts, Jennifer?
Well, in the performing arts, that's probably where I feel like I no more, because I've been doing that for so long, and I have worked with every age group. The hardest thing is when parents have their agenda that they want their child to have this special time, and the child's not having a special time. Some kids are born with more talent than others. Some kids just have a math brain. Some kids are more prone to science. Some are built with these phenomenal athletic bodies, and they just excel in those areas. And in the performing arts, it's very different, because the performing arts is really, it is kind of a selfish-centered place. You stand in front of a mirror in a dance room and you look at yourself. Now you're looking at your musculature and your alignment and seeing if everything is placed properly, but you're also looking at everyone else and seeing, oh, I look different. And so as a parent, you have to really be careful when you put your children in these arenas that they all have the ego strength to handle that, not only the physical, but also the rejection factor. Because you can be just as talented as the person next to you, but you don't get cast because perhaps you were 2 inches too tall for the leading man, or your hair color, or your body type. And once again, you really have to let your kids know that there is really nothing fair about casting. Mm-hmm. It's not fair. Just like when you have a basketball team or a football team, it's not fair. It's really the one that has the ability that fits the role. Mm-hmm. And your linebacker is going to fit a different role than your defense guy. Well, I want to be, you know, the quarterback. Well, no, because you really need to be here doing this. And that's why, you know, I'm not a football. I don't know a lot about it, but I know the big guys are in this one side of the field and the little skinny running ones are on this side of the field. Same in theater. So it's important that you don't set your kid up to feel failure. And also, you'll have kids that can sing beautifully or act beautifully, but they haven't had the training of projection. So you can't hear them. Or you have a kid that's in a garage band that shows up at auditions, and boy, they're great with a microphone, but then you have to teach them. And as a teacher at a school, you don't always have the time to be a coach. That's why you have coaches outside of school. So what I say to parents, wow, this kid's got some raw talent, but if this child wants to go to college for this, they need to be in this, 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 and this. And you can get scholarships for that, but if that's what they want, I'm telling you this because the competition is going to be really high.
But I also wonder, again, the whole, there's been such an explosion of kids that are interested in the performing arts and wanting to go get theater degrees or go get performing arts degrees in college. And I wonder sometimes how wise it is to tell every child they can win American Idol, or, you know, to encourage every child, if that's your passion, you should go do it. Don't let anyone ever tell you no. I'm conflicted with that because, as you said, there, you know, for every one child who's actually good, there's probably 1,000 that would flourish in other areas, but because they've watched so much American Idol, or they've watched all of these performance shows, The Voice, that every child thinks that they're a star. And every parent, I mean, so many parents send their children to these theater programs believing their child is the star, and they fed that story to the children. So I'm just wondering, as a teacher, how do you help kids deal with that, where there's a parent who's been telling them they're the star and you should be the lead and step out on the stage, so the child comes to you, doesn't enjoy just being in a production because their parent has kind of taken away the fun of just being in a production, the joy of just being in a show?
Well, first of all, that's the beauty of talent. It doesn't go away. It just doesn't go away. I mean, unless you are a dancer and your legs don't work anymore, or something happens to your larynx and you can no longer sing. But for the most part, that talent stays with you until you die. So what I tell my students are, you will never not be a fabulous singer or dancer. It's in you. It's there. If you choose to struggle in this career to try to actually get a job, if this is your dream, nobody's going to stop you, not your parents, anyone. But to teach them the reality of what it's like going up against 500 kids that look just like them. Mm-hmm. And I'll see parents, I'm driving to LA all the time to take their kids to auditions. If everyone is having a great time, I say, that's fantastic. But once again, you've got to teach the child what rejection feels like, and can they handle it? Mm-hmm. A lot of kids who are phenomenal, like your daughter, for instance, I've seen her perform. She may or may not have a career in theater. I think she could. I think she has the talent for it. But what I always say to these kids is, you'll still be able to be in a play. May not be Broadway, but if you love to sing, nobody can stop you, and you can still perform your dream roles. It doesn't have to be Broadway. You don't have to be in the NFL.
But
you,
I think that's...
You can be a coach like Paul and change lives every day and still play. You play tennis every day. Can you imagine your life without playing tennis?
No.
Yeah, because it's who you are.
But and I definitely appreciate that, and I definitely am a huge believer in the dream provider, you know, to have our children to dream big and have those goals. But I guess I, you know, that reluctant piece of me is always, but I see, you know, this is a little Pollyannish to me because I have raised children in the theater world and I've raised children in the athletic world and I've seen
you've
and
also
sat
raised
with all
children,
those parents.
But you've raised children in the academic world as well. Yeah. You've created a well-rounded person.
But what I'm saying is I've sat with all those parents and the part that I think concerns me is I don't think the parents' understanding of balance is there. I think that for many, many parents, their vision of what their children's abilities are is filtered because we're parents. And so it becomes, I think, the job of the coaches and the experts to help guide parents. Like Paul was saying, I kind of help parents know what their role is. That's what I see lacking is that parents have this very veiled vision of their children's abilities and they're pushing children and not noticing their temperament. And I guess that's why I want to talk about this because there's a lot of parents out there that are going, oh, yes, I'm balanced. No, it's my child's dream. And I never want anyone to say no to my child. But the truth is people are going to say no to your children and your child might not be that talented.
Well, that's why you have to
teach
them.
And maybe you shouldn't be spending $120,000 to get a musical theater degree for a child who's going to wake up at 40 and say, wow, that was a waste. I guess that's the cynical piece of me. And for you, Paul, I mean, one of the biggest drives for parents is to get athletic scholarships. Mm-hmm. More children try for athletic scholarships than any scholarships. Millions of dollars in academic scholarships go unclaimed because everyone wants to be a sports hero.
Mm-hmm.
How do you help parents come to grips with that dream if it's not really in the cards for their children?
Well, you talk to the parents and say, well, first of all, this is how much it's going to cost you to get your child a scholarship. You know,
he'll pay for the scholarship.
Right.
In
I mean, the 10,000 hours that you're going to have to spend practicing, you're going to need to be in front of somebody who knows what they're doing. And that person usually charges something. And so there's a huge financial commitment to that. And the parents will have to have a little family discussion about how are we going to afford this. And then, you know, the coach would say, you know, hey, you've got talent. This is possible. Or, in most situations, what I try to do is I try to get the parents to realize that their child is going to be a really wonderful high school player, and that they're going to be playing when they're 80, as long as their knees hold out, and you know, sell them on that part of it. Because, like you said, 2%, you know, if that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, going back to one thing you were talking about you know, the parents that you have to, that you worry about, or what are the signs? It's, mm-hmm. to me, it's the parent that lives and dies by every shot that the child hits and every point. And they'll be looking through the fence, you know, their eyes kind of glazed over, you know, and they're gnawing on something, either themselves or, their phone, who knows. And it's, I have to walk over to the parent and go, you know, your child is watching you right now. They're seeing this. They're feeling tremendous stress from you. Any chance that you might maybe move over to the bleachers and take yourself off, you know, the Velcro fence and see if you can, you know, just back off a little bit? Because if you really want to help them, don't show them so much that you want them to succeed so bad. Just accept the fact that they're out there and trying their hardest, and that's what you really want to enforce. But the parents, you know, they're still out there and they don't like it when their child, anything happens to them. You know, they're ready to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And
to question calls on the tennis courts during tournaments, right? Parents will always be the bigger problem than the kids.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, yeah, and the parent who's living vicariously through their child's accomplishments, you know, because maybe they didn't. You know, they didn't get to do it, so now, oh, my child is really good at tennis. Okay, now. And then, you know, they take the wins and losses more personally than the kid does.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I think that really is indicative of just the whole pressure of our culture in general, that it's not okay just to live a life and get up every day and enjoy it, that we as adults also feel this pressure to be the best and get the biggest house and have the best job. And so our children now have become just one more measure of our success as humans. And that's, I guess, my real concern is the play and joy of childhood for those, you know, 98% of our children. 98% of our children are just supposed to have a really nice time in the world, excelling at the things that they enjoy and never really making, you know, a splash outside of their own living room. And that's got to be enough. And I think maybe that's the focus, is how do we start. And when I think about theater, you know, when I did theater when I was in junior high, and I'm sure it's the classic line of all time, but Mr. Grayson, my beloved theater teacher, said there are no small parts, just small actors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's stuck with me my whole life. And I know, as my own child has gone through theater arts, that as a parent, I found myself a lot of times feeling anxious, like, oh, she should be, you know, in a bigger role. And then noticing that my daughter didn't care where she was. She liked snack time and liked the conversation at intermission, and she liked doing the circle before the show started. And so to be continuously step back and be able to look at my children's experience and say there are no small roles for them, because they're in a show. Or they're, you know, the tennis match is nothing, because I raised two daughters who would have much rather come to clinic their entire life and never had to call a score. So those are constant learning experiences as parents, but I don't think we as parents talk about it enough, because I think everyone's too afraid to say, you know, I'm not going to push my child. We're just going to have a good time, because the other parents look at you like you've sinned. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, in studio today with Jennifer Blomfield and Paul Fiala, and we're talking about the ups and downs and nuances of raising children and helping them nurture and enjoy performing arts or athletics in a level that is fun for them, but also knowing when we should push. When we do have a child that really needs to, you know, get prodded off the couch and say, no, you might not like practice, but you've signed up for this and you're going to finish out this season, or you're going to make it to the end of this play and you're going to give it your all. Like, because I do see parents, it's hard to find that balance. Parents are either too intense or they're too laissez-faire. So with my experts here, we're trying to figure out what might be best for all of our children, or is there a best? And we're not taking calls today, but we are having this conversation. And if you'd like to continue sharing your thoughts and ideas on this topic, you can find us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or through our website, thereluctanttherapist.com, or through our KCBX website, kcbx.org, where we have previous shows broadcasted. All right. So, Jennifer, just give me an example of a parent that you thought, and you don't tell me the parent's name, that really struggled with their role as a theater parent. And it's a story of a parent who actually really did well. Or start with the one who struggled, and Paul can do a struggle.
I think all parents, whether they struggled or not struggled, all had the same intention. They want the very best for their child. And that is our primary role as a parent, that we want our child to live in a wonderful world and be happy and be the best they can be. So there's no right or wrong. How you know if it's right or wrong is because your kids are going to let you know. They're going to either fall apart or they are going to flourish. So I don't like to give examples of the bad parent, because to me, it's not about that. It's really about really being in tune with your child and knowing when they are at the top of their game is when you can push. But when they're at the bottom, you need to teach them that this is okay too, and it's all part of it.
Yeah, finding that resilience, right? That's the
and
job.
And to me, because I work at a college prep school where the pressure is so high on academics, I tell parents, I like to create magic and memories. I'm a memory maker for these kids, because I'll have kids. I have 4 football players in the play we closed yesterday. They were probably not going to do another play, but they had the best memories. And So these, that's when it's about play. And the kids that were in the play that closed yesterday that are applying for theater schools, they all call me the night after and say, well, when's the next audition? And you can't stop them. You can't stop them for finding what they love. But in answering your question, parents, if they could just sit down with their child and say, tell me the best part of this and tell me the worst part of this. Mm. And I want to be supportive of you, and I'm going to help you. And then, as a parent, you got to also be the adult. And you need to protect your child from, sometimes coaches can say the wrong thing, sometimes teachers can say the wrong thing, and advocate for your child. I love parents, even the parents that I don't like, quote, I love that they advocate for their child, and I praise them for that.
So you don't feel that parents overstep when they question what you're doing?
Oh, all the time. Oh, yeah, but that's their job as a parent. It's my job to educate them in how to best serve their needs and their child's needs. Now, they'll either listen to me or not, but until you push a teacher or coach, you don't know what your boundary is unless they tell you. Mm-hmm. And that is where I feel I'm pretty good at it. And I feel like for the most part of all the years I've done theater, I've had 98% happy kids.
Who've enjoyed the whole process.
Yeah.
And I love the idea, too, that for a lot of them, they may never do a play again, but they'll always remember their lines from the one they did when they were in third or fourth or sixth grade.
Well, it's funny because I've had kids come back to high school reunions at Mission Prep, and they'll say, you know, my favorite memory of my senior year was doing that play. And I'm going, are you kidding? Because, I mean, these kids are so bright, and they are in the very best schools, and now they are in med school or in law school. But they go, I'll never forget that play I did. It was one of the funnest things I've ever done in my life. Yeah. So play. We're all coming back to play. Someone picked up a stick and a ball and started playing a game. And then we as human beings evolved play into competition. But that's the human way.
We do. And you mentioned earlier about kind of judging ourselves against each other and that we do that naturally. And I think especially when I came out of college, there was a lot of the push to have to minimize competition and just let kids have fun. There was a real push for that. But that as parents, we noticed that if we didn't tell them the score, the kids still knew the score. And the kids still recognized who was the better player. And so there is that natural kind of judging who's doing what. And again, for parents to find our place. And it's interesting because I'm surprised you said that's the parent's job to step in and to, you know, advocate for their child. And it's the role of the teacher and the coach to help the parents understand where they've crossed the line or where their job is.
Well, Paul said it beautifully when he said the Velcro fence. I love that. I've never heard that expression.
Back away a little bit. Let go the helicoptering. So, Paul, how about you, an example of a parent that or an experience that you felt really went well for a child, that they were nurtured well?
Gosh. Most of the parents, I mean, if you have a really good communication time with the parent, you teach them right away that this is what your kid's going to need as far as tennis goes, because, you know, in a tournament of 128, 127 lose. You know, and so they have to know how to lose and that it's okay. That's the biggest thing that I teach parents is that, you know, your child is out there, they're trying, you're living and dying by every shot they miss, and when they come off, your first thing that you want to do is fix them. You know, as a parent, you were like, I got to fix this. You're going to clinic, and you're going to take five lessons, and, you know, and it's I like to just put my arm around him and say, you know, he really worked hard today. Did you see how hard? You know, that was great. And, you know, he left it all on the court. That was, you know, and so you try to get them to see that the winning and losing isn't important. In fact, I think by losing, you learn more anyway.
Well said.
From failure. So, you know, as long as everybody else isn't piling on you about having lost and you're not taking some sort of blame, you're going, okay, yeah, I lost, but yeah, I left it on the court. What else could you ask? I mean, that's tried, you know. So when I'm watching a high school match, I'm walking to all the parents and talking to each one of them about how great their kid is competing. I don't worry about the score so much because I can hear it from them. You know, I'll be talking to them, and all of a sudden you hear, and I'm like, oh, your little Bobby just missed a forehand. Okay, you know. And you just keep trying to calm them down and realize that you're supporting them. That's the biggest thing. And after they're done, to know that they are still a great kid.
I think I'm starting to cry because I'm thinking about all my experiences with my girls and wanting to go back and redo a few. But also the idea that maybe our most important job as parents is to help our children learn how to fail or lose. Mm-hmm. Because if 127 children are going to lose in a tournament, or 500 want to come out for one role, 499 are going to. So the experience of failure is going to be much more prevalent in our lives than the moments of glory. And to help our children learn how to carry on after disappointment is going to be a much more important gift than anything else. And then maybe it comes down to us as parents teaching ourselves how to deal with failure or disappointment or loss, that when it's evident that our child isn't going to be the next Olympian or they're just going to have fun, that we need to first as parents find our grace and okayness with that, so that we can get for our children. Because I think so many parents are still wrapped up in their own feeling of loss or disappointment in their own choices that they're hoping their child will redeem them. And so it makes it even more difficult for their children to learn it. So my takeaway today is really it starts with us as adults to give ourselves grace and understand that failure and disappointment and loss is going to be probably more common than the few wins. And to enjoy the wins, but to really learn to deal with the loss. This has been a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, here today with Jennifer Blomfield and Paul Fiala. And just final thoughts from both of you. What advice would you like to give to parents, if you could have them in this room, about helping their children?
Love your children as you already do. Listen to your children. Be their advocate. And take the time to find those hidden talents and nurture it the best you can. And you don't need to have money to do that. There are so many ways to give your child the opportunities. And then ask experts. Go to parents that you see that have kids that are doing well and say, how did you do this? Because each child is different. They all have different personalities. And you have to take each child individually, because each one is so unique that you cannot put them with all the others.
Absolutely. And I do think mentors for parents is so essential to see
yes.
someone who's done
Ask
it well.
Ask people, yeah.
And Paul, last thoughts, final thoughts for parents out there.
Just if the kids are smiling, it's good. You know? And if they're learning and they're just understanding how to, I mean, as a coach, I'm trying to instill ideas of, you know, hard work and discipline, but at the same time having a blast, having so much fun. Because you'll have more fun if you're enjoying what it is you're doing. And so, I mean, my job isn't a job at all. I love it.
And for me, what I found over the last few years is I've gone out and started playing tennis with Paul a few years ago, and getting on the court and going, feeling the challenges of getting my forehand groove and my backhand groove, and it gave me such greater perspective for my kids and grace for the challenge of getting your body to move and do what you want. And so I encourage parents, go do some voice or audition for a community play so that you can remember how scary it is to have to audition and put yourself out there. The things that we're asking our children to do, right. We need to remind ourselves and do it ourselves, to put ourselves in those positions of pursuing a passion, feeling disappointed, or doing something out of our comfort zone. We're modeling for our children how great it is to take a chance, and we're also reminding ourselves of some of what our children might experience day to day. I want to thank you both for coming in today and talking with us. I encourage you to join us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or look for previous shows on kcbx.org. We will be back next week to take your calls. Thank you, Brian, and thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX.